How do you turn plastic used in soda bottles into a living organ? We'll take a look at how surgeons in Sweden transplanted a synthetic windpipe into a cancer patient, not once, but twice, with the help of stem cells. Plus, could hot rocks at a dormant volcano or floating wind turbines off the coast of Maine be practical sources of renewable energy? We'll talk about thinking out of the box in the search for energy alternatives. Finally, the grounding of the cruise ship in Italy had us wondering, with all kinds of modern navigational technology on board, how could such a disaster happen? We'll examine the role of high tech in safely steering ships. All that in this month's Science Diction, The Origin of the Word Moon. After this, stay with us. If Science Friday is music to your ears, hey, you ought to try us in Technicolor. We make videos too. Subscribe to our free video podcast on iTunes or watch them through our website at sciencefriday.com. I'm sure you'll enjoy them. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. An American cancer patient became the second person in the world to receive a synthetic windpipe transplant. Surgeons in Sweden replaced the patient's cancerous windpipe with one that was grown in the laboratory. It was made from plastic nanofibers and seeded with the patient's stem cells. But just how was this artificial organ turned into a functioning airway? And how can this experimental procedure be used on other organs, perhaps lungs, even the heart in the future? My next guest, Dr. Paola Macchiarini, was the lead surgeon for both synthetic windpipe transplants. Dr. Macchiarini is the director of the Advanced Center for Translational Regenerative Medicine at Karolinska Institute in Stockholm, Sweden. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us. Let's start at the beginning. How was the scaffold for the synthetic trachea built?
Well, basically, from the, by the same fibers that everybody of us has, in the sense of nanofibers, very, very small fibers that compose the native, the human trachea. So when we wanted to transplant this organ, we thought, what is best? And the best would be to just replicate what human nature has done. And this is the reason why we use these very thin fibers.
And then you seeded the fibers, the mold, so to speak, the plastic, with the patient's own stem cells.
Exactly, because this first step, the generation of the scaffold, was entirely made in the laboratory. But without the cells, this scaffold could not be implanted because the trachea is the only organ which is in contact with the external environment. So if you put a prosthesis or a synthetic material in contact, it becomes infected, and you can have different lethal problems. By reseeding the scaffold with the patient's own stem cells, we were making living a plastic tissue.
Did the stem cells then start to grow as trachea cells?
Well, when the first step is to produce a nano composite, then the second step is to take the stem cells of the patient. The third step is to put the two together using a so-called bioreactor, which is a shoebox where you put these liquid containing the cells and the scaffold. And the cells are attracted by this scaffold because it is biomaterial and permits attachment of cells. And the cells are not only attaching, but then start to proliferate, are living, so that they feel like they would be in a physiological environment. Mm-hmm. Once you have done this, you implant this in the human body, and you give bioactive molecules that differentiate the stem cells into the cells of the trachea. And this happens usually within 14 days after the transplantation.
And so that the stem cells basically grow and become part of the trachea.
Well, rather than growing, they differentiate into the given specific cells. And avoid infection, avoid death and necrosis of the graft, yes.
Mm-hmm. And so by the time you transplant it back into the patient, you have the plastic structure and you have tracheal cells that you're putting back into the patient?
Well, we have the nanocomposite. We have cells, but these are not tracheal cells because in such a short time you cannot differentiate the cells. You just can have cells that are living, and once they are implanted in the human body, we use the human body as a so-called own bioreactor, and we boost the regeneration.
And so how long would it take for those cells to regenerate once they're back in the human?
Well, after 1 week of the transplantation, we did an endoscopy. That means an evaluation of the graft. And by taking the cells out, we were finding evidence that the cells of the trachea inside the disease were already there. So in as short as 7 days, you can have differentiated cells starting from not differentiated cells.
And how long would it take to cover and make a complete trachea?
Well, we did before the last patient came home, we did again an endoscopy, and it was lined with the cells. And today we just proved with the pathologist that the cells were all there. So probably this depends as well on the three-dimensional measures of the trachea, because if it is a very long, it is a trachea with bifurcation, so that many factors play a role. But usually, within 2 to 3 weeks, if you tell the body to boost, to accelerate regeneration, you can get a complete differentiated trachea.
2 to 3 weeks, you can make the whole trachea.
Well, wow. Using the human body as a bioreactor, yes.
Yeah. So I imagine you could try to do this with other organs in the body, other things.
We are starting to learn what happens with this still experimental therapy. So I'm not so pessimistic to try to do the same with other tissues or organs. And since I'm a thoracic surgeon, I deal with organs of the chest. So I would think at the esophagus, at the chest wall, at the liver, at the lung, and eventually at the heart. Yes.
And how are the patients doing?
Well, probably there was a huge media coverage when he came back in the United States, and he's doing very well. He was seen yesterday by his referring physician in Baltimore, and as far as I know, he's doing fine.
Can you reconstruct blood vessels this way?
Well, actually, the Yale University has started to a clinical trial approved by the FDA using tissue engineering vessels in children. So the answer would be yes.
Mm-hmm. And just to understand more completely, the trachea is, it has a microfiber backbone to it, and on top of which you have permeated with stem cells. And the stem cells have been coaxed into becoming tracheal cells.
Exactly.
And then they have now totally covered and taken over on top of this structure of plastic. They have now become sort of a living organism?
Yes, sir.
Wow. And you did this all, it all happened within just a matter of a few weeks.
Well, usually, again, depending on the of difficulty of the three-dimensional aspect of the tissue, you can produce a trachea, for instance, just a tube in 2 days, and a bifurcated trachea in 10 days. So now, then you need 2 days for getting the cells receding the graft. So in 2 weeks, you have an entire trachea.
And perhaps you might extend it your work further because you deal in this and possibly into the lungs.
Well, ideally, yes. But to me, my dream would be another one. Rather than replacing the lung or replacing the heart, to use cell therapy to treat these organs before they ultimately do not work anymore. So rather than doing a transplantation, just when we have the first signs of insufficiency, whether to treat these organs with the patient's stem cells, probably targeting the defect that they have, so prolonging and extending their life.
So if you have untreatable tumors, for example, within the patient, you might be able to, instead of putting a new part in, put the stem cells in, and they would grow into the to replace that.
Well, I don't think that this is so easy. We first need to be very cautious to identify so-called cancer stem cells, because within a cancer, you have cells that proliferate forever and have many of the aspects of undifferentiated and ever-proliferating stem cells. Mm-hmm. So whether we could target these cells to block the growth and eventually treat cancer, this is a very, very early.
So what makes your technique so revolutionary?
Well, the fact that, first of all, in 6 months we were able to treat 31 and 30 years, respectively, young gentlemen that had an tumor of the trachea and are still alive. So the revolution is there because there would be any other treatment options. And the second evolution is that to me is too much. But the new thing is that we saw in the blood of the patients stem cells that as soon as they, all three after transplant, were already expressing the profile of respiratory cells. So they were recruited from the peripheral blood and went home to the site of the transplant to make the cells of the trachea. So that means that indeed we could do and replicate this for other types of cells, like the liver, kidney, heart, or so we just need time and much more economic support to prove this concept.
Yes, time and money. That's all we need.
Exactly, as usually. Exactly.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Macchiarini, for for taking time to talk with us. Dr. Paolo Macchiarini is the director of the Advanced Center for Translational Regenerative Medicine at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm, Sweden. We're going to take a break. After the break, we're going to look at two renewable energy projects using pioneering technology, one that taps the heat that causes under volcanoes. Yeah, and another project to float wind turbines off the coast of Maine in really deep water, not close to the shore, but far away so you can't even see them from the shore, in deep water, creating, you know, electrical energy that way. We'll talk about it when we get back. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. We'll be right back after this break. Hi, SciFry fans. There's a new app in town. If you're listening to this on our SciFry iPhone or iPad app, there's a newer, better app waiting for you to download on iTunes, the SciFry Booster Edition. It's loaded with new features like playlists, Twitter, Facebook, and other goodies. It's optimized for your iPad. The videos look terrific. An Android app is in the works, too, so please be patient. For you iOS fans, just go to the iTunes Store and search for the SciFry BE app. That's the SciFry BE app. Download and enjoy. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We here at Science Friday are constantly on the lookout for cool, innovative, renewable energy ideas. And when we came across these next two, we knew, I just knew I had to share them with you. First, our first one. We go to a dormant volcano in Oregon. It's the site of a renewable energy project that involves hot rocks, millions of gallons of cold water, and cutting-edge geothermal technology. Susan Petty is the president and chief technology officer for Alter Rock Energy, one of the collaborators on this project. She joins us from Seattle. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Good to get to talk to you.
Hope you were weathering the storm out there.
Well, I had to stay home today because we have 10 inches of snow out here and the road hasn't been plowed yet, but...
Well, what better way than to share your phone call with us then today?
Absolutely. And we can talk about heat, which is
a good
thing.
Let's talk about how are you going to use this volcano? Tell us about this dormant volcano in Oregon. You're going to use it to generate power.
Okay, well, we were very fortunate. Altaroc Energy is a company that's been focused on advanced technology for using geothermal energy for since 2007. And we found that the some folks, Davenport Energy, our partners, had drilled two wells at Newberry Volcano looking for a conventional geothermal resource, and they didn't find it. What they found, though, was a lot of heat really close to the surface. And so we came to them and said, look, we've developed this advanced technology that should let us get this heat out, even though you don't have the normal cracks and hot water that would be in place for a conventional geothermal resource.
So you made lemonade out of lemons when you got there and decided to try something new.
Something new, and it really is new. I mean, there have been other projects where people have drilled down, gotten into hot rock, and made fractures, and then circulated cold water down the one well and produced it hot out of another well. There are two projects like that, one in Germany and one in France, and they're generating electricity now. The problem is that it's only economic to do this in some very special places, or if you have the kinds of price incentives that they have in Europe to get people to do that.
So what you're aiming to do is to do what? You have the rocks, you have the hot rocks there. You will send cold water down, heat it up, bring it back up to the surface?
That's right. And what we are going to do at this particular experiment is we already have a well. That's great. And it's very hot. So what we'll do is we'll put this cold water down. And the combination of the cold and a little bit of extra pressure allows the rock to start to fracture. And then we can extend those fractures out from that first place, and as they extend out, they will bifurcate and create, and new little fractures will open up. That makes little snapping and popping sounds, which we can use to map where the fractures are going, and we do that from the surface using sensitive seismic instruments. Then when we finish making one set of fractures, the new thing is that we then pump a suspension of little plastic bits into the crack we've made. That stops that crack going, allows us to let the pressure come up a little bit more in the well, and then the cold water can move out and down and extend out another set of fractures in the well. And we can then put the plastic bits in that set of fractures. We can do that again and again until we're happy with what we got. And then when we stop pumping the cold water, This plastic is a biodegradable type of plastic that will then, as it heats up, break apart into little tiny components of the polymer that will be completely soluble in water, and we can then produce them out.
So you're making sort of a pool or a reservoir of hot water underground.
That's right, a reservoir in little cracks. I don't want you to think of it as an underground lake.
Right.
It's a reservoir in that it's a bunch of tiny little cracks. And the more tiny cracks we can make, the better we can get at that heat that volcano.
This is not like fracking for natural gas, is it?
No, because in fracking for natural gas, they want a great big huge crack, which they then hold open with proppant,
right,
with sand. And we don't want that because that wouldn't get us access to that rock that we want to contact with our cold water to get it to heat up.
How hot does the water get?
Well, we're very lucky. Because this is a volcano, it gets quite hot. So the temperatures in this well are higher than 600 degrees F. They're above 320 C.
Wow. So does the water, that superheated water then?
Yeah, so the water will get that hot, and it will then come out of the production wells at that temperature. And we'll be able to, we have two options then as it comes out of the well. We can either take the steam part, it'll boil,
right,
and we then can separate the steam and the water and put the steam through a steam turbine, which is probably what we'll do. But we have another option, and that is that we can take the full stream of hot water and put it into heat exchangers and boil another fluid, and that will vaporize, and that can go through a turbine. Either way, it's a closed loop. We take all of this water that comes out, take the heat out of it to make the electricity, and then we put it right back in the ground.
So it's sort of like a boiling water nuclear reactor, sort of, but without the nuclear reactor.
Well, you know what? At this place, it's without the nuclear reactor, but everywhere you go on Earth, the deeper you go, the hotter it gets. And that actually is kind of a nuclear reactor, because that heat comes largely from radioactive decay of radioactive isotopes that are in the crust of the Earth. So it's kind of a very diffuse and controlled nuclear reactor there under us.
Yeah. So when does this all happen?
Well, okay, so the schedule is that we've just completed our environmental permitting work. The Bureau of Land Management has released our environmental study for public comment. We have got that public comment period almost done. The BLM will then say, go ahead. And we also have a grant from the Department of Energy to help us do this experiment. So they'll say, go ahead. And we have to put in some more sensitive seismic instruments, and that will be happening in the spring. We will then rig up and start the stimulation experiment probably at the end of July, beginning of August.
So you're saying it's technologically feasible, but you have to discover whether it makes economic sense, right?
This is the big part of this, Ira. You know, right now we could do this pretty much anywhere. We have the technical capability to generate power from this type of method any place that you would want to try and do it.
Right.
The problem is it's just not economic. The wells are deep and expensive, and we don't get that much power out of each one, so it wouldn't be justified. We're hoping that this new method, where we can get a lot more of the hot rock contacted and therefore produce more hot water out of each production well, will make this much more economic. And so then we can move off the flanks of dormant volcanoes where it's really hot close to the surface and go to places where we would find more normal levels of heat at depth and use this technology to make power a lot of places. That's the goal.
Well, we wish you luck, and we'll be watching to see how this turns out.
Well, that's great, and we'll let you know what happens.
All right, we'll be watching. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
Susan Petty is President and Chief Technology Officer for Altaroc Energy, one of the collaborators on this project. We're going to move on now to offshore. The other project I talked about that was really different that we kind of like to look into, this is going offshore to deep waters in the Gulf of Maine, and that's where a group called Deep Sea Wind Consortium hopes to one day see 100 floating wind turbines, each as tall as the Washington Monument, harvesting wind energy. Well, we know all about wind turbines, but the difference here, these turbines are going to be in deep water, way out to sea. You won't even be able to see them. Habib Dagher is a director of the Advanced Structures and Composite Center at the University of Maine, which leads the consortium. He joins us from Orono. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
Did I describe that correctly?
That's very well done.
You're not going to start out with 100 of them, are you? You can just try one or two?
We're going to walk before we run on this. And we started actually with scale models. These turbines, when they're completed, they'll be about 300 feet to the hub, about 5 to 10 megawatt turbines. The blades would be close to 180 feet long per blade. So what we've done is we've started with smaller specimens, they're 150 scale units that we put in a wave wind basin. These were about 6 feet to the hub. The blades were 4 feet long. And we put them through essentially a variety of designed storms to understand how they perform in 100-year storms. If you've seen the movie The Perfect Storm, we actually created many perfect storms in a wave wind facility. And that's where we started.
And you found that they can resist some of these great storms and not be in danger of capsizing or getting wrecked.
That's correct. That's the purpose of the experiments. One reason we ran the experiments is to see how these actually perform, but also to try to understand how to predict how they will perform in a variety of environments.
Now, what makes Maine or the offshore part of Maine a good place to do this?
Within 50 miles of the Gulf of Maine, of the state of Maine, there's about 150 gigawatts of offshore wind capacity. That's about 150 nuclear power plants worth of wind. And the state of Maine only uses 2.4 gigawatts of electricity at the peak summer period. So we've got quite a bit of resource out there. The state of Maine also has a maritime history with Bath Ironworks and others who've built ships and so forth. So it made sense for us to harness this resource and then build on an existing industry base.
Mm-hmm. And this is the first time this idea will be tried in the U.S.?
That's correct. That's the first time it'll be tried in the U.S.
Has it been tried elsewhere?
Yes. There's currently an international race to go after what we call deep water offshore wind. And the reason is there's so much resource out there, and it's close to major cities across the globe. To put things in perspective, there's enough offshore wind capacity around the U.S. coasts, within 50 miles of the U.S. coast, to power the U.S. four times over. And about 75% of that is in 100 feet of water or more. So it's a huge resource in the U.S. It's also a huge resource globally. The first operating floating wind turbine in the world was put out in Norway by a company called Statoil about a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm. Now, Cape Wind, and off, I'm sure, as you know, off of Nantucket, has been having trouble with the local people saying this is an eyesore. You won't have that trouble because they're so far offshore?
That's correct. Our plan in Maine is to place these turbines between 20 and 50 miles offshore, so you won't see them because of the curvature of the Earth. We've run the University of Maine, through the National Science Foundation-funded program, ran surveys across the Gulf of Maine, across the state of Maine, to over 6,000 people, and the support was over 98% for the concept.
And you would run a cable back to the shoreline?
That's correct. And that technology is fairly well known right now. In Europe, they've been building offshore wind farms since 1991. And even in the U.S., we've built a number of these undersea cables, if you wish. Yes, there'll be one cable that will come from a farm to a location on land.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR. Talking with Dr. Habib Dagher, a director of the Advanced Structures and Composite Center at the University of Maine. You could be an exporter of electricity, could you not?
Yes, absolutely. The state of Maine has put a plan together that to produce close to 5 gigawatts of offshore wind by 2030. That's the equivalent of 5 nuclear power plants worth of wind when the wind's blowing, of course, and with an average output of 40% of that over the year, that's about 2 gigawatts. We can't use all 2 gigawatts in Maine, at least just for electricity. We plan to use it to heat homes, and we plan to use it to also fill up cars, essentially the electrical cars and hybrid vehicles of the future. And then the rest of it, of course, we could sell on the New England grid.
Tell us your time schedule on this.
We've just finished doing this last year, the 150 scale models that we just discussed. At this stage of the game, we're designing a 1-6 scale unit that's going to be deployed in the spring of 2013, spring of next year, in the water off the Gulf of Maine. Following that, our goal is to put a small farm off the Gulf of Maine and to start constructing that in 2016 and have it operational 2017. The state of Maine has put out a bid for this farm right now, for this demonstration farm, and the Maine PUC is in the process of selecting a winning bidder for that project. And then following that, between 2017 and 2020, the goal is to expand that to a larger farm in the order of a 500-megawatt farm. So that farm would have, say, 105-megawatt turbines.
And there's no reason why other places up and down the East Coast could not do the same thing.
Absolutely. So there's a lot of opportunities all across the United States and beyond to do this kind of thing. And actually, Japan, as we speak, the Japanese Parliament just 2 months ago has allocated $250 million to build 6 floating turbines off Fukushima because of the nuclear disaster in the area. They're looking for alternatives to nuclear energy, and they have deep waters off their coast. So they're looking at floating wind turbines as well. The UK right now is also looking at doing that. So there's an international race to go to deep water offshore wind technology.
And, you know, what do you say to people who say, well, you know, the wind doesn't blow all the time?
That's correct. We all know that very well. And typically, in most places in the U.S., you can integrate wind and you can deal with that. When you're in about less than 10% penetration of wind on the grid, if you go over 10%, you start to have to do some things to back up the wind and so forth. So you can accommodate accommodate up to 10% penetration in most locations without a lot of trouble. Because what's happening is we already deal with an uncertain grid because the load changes throughout the day and throughout the week and so forth. So we know how to deal with an uncertain load, if you wish. So up to 10% in most places, we're okay. And 10% of, say, in the New England area, the grid is about a 30-gigawatt grid. So getting up to 3 gigawatts in the New England grid would be very doable without a lot of effort.
But you're saying there's potential to go a lot further.
There's potential to go significantly higher than that, of course, with backing up the wind properly. And also, how do you use the wind? If you use the wind, say, to fill up cars, one of the best ways to store renewables is in electric vehicles. If we look down the road 10 or 20 years in the U.S., if we start, say, having a 20 or 30 or 40 or 50% penetration of these vehicles, they're like a bunch of batteries. They're not all in one place, but they're a large distributed battery. And most of us use our cars less than an hour a day. So the other 23 hours, they're sitting there, and they can be taking that energy and storing it. And essentially what we'll be doing is we'll be displacing using fossil fuels, gasoline, and replacing that with renewable power. So that could be stored, if you wish, in these vehicles.
All right.
You can also use it to heat homes with it, and you can store that energy as well.
So sort of distributed storage instead of centralized.
And certainly there's one of the many ways you could use to address some of the, if you wish, the intermittency of the wind.
Well, Dr. Dagar, I wish you good luck.
Thank you.
We'll be following. We'd love to look at the really creative alternative energies, renewable sources, and we'll be following Dr. Habib Dagar, who is Director of Advanced Structures and Composite Center at the University of Maine. Will we see a whole bunch of fleet of floating turbines off the coast? Science is now sexy. Science has become the theme of TV shows and Broadway plays, film and artwork. And we think it's a real trend, and we've created a whole science and arts section right on our website, entertaining interviews with artists and actors, scientists and celebrities. It's the only one of its kind, and I invite you to check it out at sciencefriday.com/arts. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Last week, a cruise ship carrying more than 4,000 people ran aground off the coast of Italy, resulting in the loss of numerous lives, not to mention damage to the ship. It struck a rocky outcropping clearly visible on the chart, tearing a gash in its hull, which leaves us wondering how in this age of GPS, sonar, other high-tech navigational devices could such a tragedy occur? Did it veer dangerously off course? What kind of technology does the crew of large cargo and cruise ships depend on? Joining us to talk about this and answer some of those questions is Max Van Noorden. He's coordinator of the Hydrographic Science Program in the Department of Marine Sciences at the University of Southern Mississippi in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much, Ira. I'm glad to be on your show.
You're welcome. Is this a common occurrence?
Not really. This is really a case of gross stupidity.
Why do you say that?
Well, because a modern navigational system, which would have been present on a ship like the Costa Concordia, would have definitely warned the crew, the bridge crew, and the captain that they were, you know, had to make corrective actions. A modern navigational system, which is called an ECDIS, an electronic chart display and information system, really gives great improvement in navigational safety because, first of all, it gives great improvement in situational awareness. It automatically plots the position of the ship, as you mentioned, with GPS. It also automatically plots the positions of other ships within its radar range, and from that project. From the course and speeds, whether there's a problem with possible collisions with other ships. It also plots what we call AIS targets, automatic identification system targets, which every major ship today has to carry an AIS transponder after 9/11, because these transponders give the ship's position, its course, its speed, what cargo it carries, where it's coming from, where it's going, what flag it flies, so forth. But from the Concordia's AIS receiver, they could also have plotted all the AIS targets as well. And so a ECDIS system gives greatly improved situational awareness of the water space the ship is going in, and there to prevent collisions with other ships. And then, in addition to that, these systems allow for voyage planning, where the navigator sets out their exact track that they want to follow in each course change, based upon an electronic navigational chart. And if the navigator should set out a course or a planned course in this voyage planning that takes it over a hazardous area, the ECDIS system will tell him, you can't. This is a bad track. You know, change your voyage plan to a more safer track. So it's also a great improvement in voyage planning. And then the third thing is the route monitoring part. It actually gives you warnings when you exceed the allowances for danger. In the voyage planning, you'll put in things like the ship's characteristics, its turning radius, and things like that. It's allowable draft. And if it gets too close and the standoff allowances to navigational hazards, and if it exceeds those allowances, the system will give out warnings. You know, think of the Exxon Valdez, for instance, in 1989. That accident could have been prevented with an ECDIS system. They didn't have ECDIS at that time, but if you recall, there was an inexperienced third mate on the bridge who failed to make a critical course change, and an ECDIS system would have warned him, say, "You got to make this turn at this time," and as the ship was going off towards a navigational hazard, the ECDIS system would have given him a warning, saying, "You're getting too close to this navigational hazard," or the depth sounder, which is interfaced with an ECDIS system, would have told him, The bottom is getting too shallow. You need to take corrective actions. So all these are great improvements in navigational safety that these modern electronic chart display information systems provide to the mariner.
And the location of the underwater hazards are also well known, like the rock that it hit.
Well, in this case, yes. But you bring up something. There are some pitfalls to these navigational systems. Particularly, I think, in my opinion, affect the cruise line industry, because these displays, these are all very colorful, you know, computer monitors and displays that sort of lull in complacency. The fact the database for these ECDIS systems is the electronic navigational chart, and it looks very colorful as well. But in many cases, that information on that chart is based on very old data. NOAA, for instance, who's responsible for charting U.S. waters, I've seen a presentation where they say that 50% of the data on their charts were collected by hydrographic surveys before 1940 with old technology. And so in areas that are well-traveled by, say, container ships or tankers, whatever, these well-traveled routes are well-charted. But these cruise liners, they like to go off the beaten path and show, you know, pristine areas, picturesque areas to the passengers. So they're going off the beaten path into areas that are not well surveyed, or maybe they've been surveyed many, many years ago with old technology, even by Captain Cook, even. But in any case, these areas, in fact, they may not have never been surveyed in some cases of Alaska, where the glaciers have receded, and these cruise liners going to these areas and watching these beautiful glacier areas may have never the waters, however, may never been surveyed. So for these cruise ships, they're going off the beaten path and putting these $500 million ships at some risk with the passengers, of course, by going into these areas that are not well surveyed. Even though the chart might look very fancy and colorful. Mm-hmm. And a very colorful display on this modern integrated bridge, but that underlying data would have been collected in many cases with very old technology.
Mm-hmm. But the case of last week, this was not that case, was it?
No, it was not. This is just really a case where, from my readings, the Costa Concordia had a modern navigation system, modern ECDIS system. It would have given him a number of warnings that he's getting too close, I'm sure. But I guess in his case, in the captain's case, he just turned off the warnings and ignored them.
Would there not be other members of the crew on the bridge there?
There would. And I was wondering why the chief mate would not have jumped in saying, "Captain, you're taking ship into dangerous waters here. But, you know, I'm just speculating.
Right. So there's enough electronics on the ship to let you know, at least in that case, to let you know where you are exactly.
Exactly.
To let you know exactly what is around you. And it's up to you to decide whether to listen to it or not.
Yes. And in the case of the Costa Concordia, of course, I mentioned how every large ship has to have an AIS receiver these days. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, it was constantly transmitting those AIS transmissions, and there are stations ashore that pick that up and can simulate exactly where that ship was through that whole ordeal. And in fact, that's a very good website that gives some explanations of where the ship went.
What website is that?
One that I saw that was really good is gcaptain.com, where they show using the AIS data exactly where the ship traveled, and the narrator gave a very good explanation of what he thought happened.
gcaptain.com?
Yes.
Let me go to the phones to Matt in Alexandria, Virginia. Hi, Matt. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, hello.
Hi there. Go ahead.
I was curious. I used to be a second mate, and I was wondering if the Voyage data recorder info had been recovered, and if so, would it ever be made public?
I saw a picture of them recovering the Voyage data recorder.
Is that like the recorder on an airplane when it goes down?
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's been recovered, and that would have the record of where it went.
Yes.
Matt, does this surprise you as a second mate?
Yes. The ships I've been on have all had one. We never had to do anything with it. I mean, it was sort of a passive thing, but we were under the instructions or understanding that if something happened, it would be one of the first things recovered, yeah. And the data it records would be used to recreate what happened prior to the incident.
All right. Thanks for calling. 1-800-989-8255. Talking with Max Van Norden. So you're saying that there's a lesson here about the future of cruise shipping and knowing where you are and the ancient charts that you were not joking that some of these go back to Captain Cook.
No, I wasn't. Another example, the QE2 grounded off of Martha's Vineyards a couple of years ago, I think 1992. They went off the beaten path and grounded off in an area that hadn't been surveyed since 1939. So, I mean, these things happen.
And you say they go off the beaten path because the captain may want to get the passengers a special look at something or get close to a glacier in Alaska?
Yeah. Right. That's part of the deal for these cruise liners. They take you into picturesque, you know, pristine areas of Alaska and other areas. And have the passengers see some very beautiful scenery, but in a number of cases these are unsurveyed or very old surveyed areas.
Mm-hmm. And the alarms could be going off on the ship. They're literally off the chart when they do these things.
Well, you see, in that case, the alarms wouldn't necessarily go off because the ship relies or the ECDIS system relies on the known data.
Mm-hmm.
Of the electronic navigational chart. And so if there's nothing to tell, nothing in the data to say that there's, you know, there's a danger, if the rocks haven't been discovered that will ground the ship, if those shoals have not been discovered, there's no, the alarms wouldn't necessarily go off.
Mm-hmm. But in a normal course of a cruise, we would expect that this is, if you stay on course, this cruise has taken, this captain and his crew have taken this trip 100 times at least. And know exactly where everything is, and they're quite safe.
Right. If they follow, you know, the normal shipping lanes or the shore, wow. or have taken these cruises along that line before, then it should be safe. Yes.
Hmm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR. Talking with Max Van Norden, who is coordinator of the Hydrographic Science Program at the University of Southern Mississippi in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. So, what is your recommendation here, Dr. Van Norden?
Well, of course, one recommendation would be to follow the advice of your ECDIS system and not overrule it. But the other thing is that we need, you know, more hydrographic surveys in those areas where these cruise liners are going.
Yeah, and
modern surveys.
And we need to have captains to take less risk.
Yes, absolutely.
What is the normal sequence of an investigation that would go on now?
Well, that's really out of my area. I'm sure the Italian version of their Coast Guard would be following that investigation, and they would have to present the evidence to a maritime court of some type. And generally, these things follow some sort of maritime law.
Mm-hmm. As far as knowing where you are in the water and what's around you, would not sonar on your own ship tell you that there are these rocks right next door to you, where you're going?
Well, most ships do carry a depth sounder, mm-hmm. but in the case of a ship like the Concordia, which has a great mast behind it, there would be. They don't have the type of sonar, probably the forward-looking type of sonar. Let's say a warship would have. They would have a more commercial down-looking sonar, and there was probably no way they would detect something in time like that. They can only see a prevailing trend, say in the bottom, but an all of a sudden type hazard that's in the way. No, they would have to depend upon the charts to tell them there's a hazard. And of course, in his case, he needed to follow the charts instead of just thinking that he could get away with what he did.
Yeah, if you have the chart, you got to use it.
That's correct.
And the charts that he uses, no reason to believe these were ancient charts. And as we talked about before, he had been over. I mean, this is just a normal course that this cruise liner took all the time.
Well, no, not in this particular case, though. I mean, in this sail by that he did, he had done it, I believe, one time before, but in slightly different headings. And so what he did was actually, unauthorized and unusual. Now, what I meant was normally ships would stay, farther away from an island like that in the normal shipping lanes. And that would have been a safe course of action.
Dr. Van Noorden, thank you very much for taking time to be with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Max Van Noorden of Southern University of Southern Mississippi in Hattiesburg. Time for Howard Markel to talk about our latest word of the week. Welcome to Science Friday.
Good afternoon, Ira.
Let's talk about what our word for today is. Moon, is it not?
The word is moon. And, it's not surprising as we look at the heavens. It's captured the imagination and the cosmology of for centuries of people who looked at it. It comes from an old English word, mona, but there are many other languages, old Germanic, old Saxon, old Dutch, old Nordic, that have similar words for it. But by the 15th century, English-speaking people began calling it the moon, although they often spelled it M-O-O-N-E.
And so I always thought it was like lunar or luna stuff was.
Well, that's the Latin word for moon, of course. And Luna was the Roman goddess of the moon. And now they, of course, stole it from the Greeks. The Romans stole a lot of things from the Greeks. But the Greek goddess of the moon was named Selina. And that word that comes from the word selas, which means brightness. But we still use lunar as an adjective all the time. But in antiquity, it not only referred to things like insanity, a lunatic or a lunacy, but also a woman's menstrual cycle, which is 28 days, just like the orbit of the moon around the Earth.
Mm. And so where did the man in the moon come from?
Ah, the man in the moon. Well, if you look at the moon, particularly when it's a full moon, you can imagine a face. Now, other people have said they can imagine a man carrying sticks or a man with a dog. My favorite is you can imagine a rabbit standing on its hind legs, but I don't know what those people are drinking. But you see it in a lot of examples in literature and the Bible and so on. But there actually was a book called The Man in the Moon. It was written by a man named Francis Godwin. It was published in 1638. And Ira, it may be the first example of science fiction in English literature because it details a voyage to the moon.
All right, Howard Markel, we have an abbreviated version. We've run out of time. I want to thank you for joining us today.
Always a pleasure.
Howard Markel, professor of history of medicine at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor.
Support for Science Friday comes from the S.D. Bechtel Jr. Foundation.
Our program's senior producer is Annette Heiss. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Intagliata and Alessio Bayek. Sam Flato is our production assistant. Our intern is Francie Deep. Neil Rausch is our technical director and at the controls here in New York. I'm Ira Flatow. Thanks for listening.